The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Welcome back to Millennial 2023. I'm now here with History Bro. History Bro was requested by quite a few people, and this was agreed about 6 months ago. We got in touch and agreed to do this. So thank you for that, Bo, and welcome to Millennial. This is your debut on Millennial, so thank you for doing this. Welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me, Rose. Really, really appreciate it. This is sort of my maiden voyage on your channel. So, no, I really, really appreciate it. And it was really nice to hear that you said just before we started that a few people have requested me. So that is, that's actually really nice. But yeah, I also just got in touch with you and more than happy to do this. So a little bit about me. I've got my own channel, History Bro. Which has been going for quite a few years now. It's not all that big. I think YouTube strangled it after I put up some slightly questionable content one time. Got some warnings. It never really seems to have grown after that. But I also work for Lotus Eaters. You had that Harry Robinson chap on, didn't you?
I did. I thought that one went very well. I like him. Yeah.
Harry's great. I sit near him in an office 5 days a week. So, he's great. He's great. I do sort of history and politics themed and some literary stuff for themed content for Lotus Eaters. And so mainly history stuff, though. I mean, my undergrad degree was in ancient history. I got a postgrad in government policy and politics as well. So but history is my main thing, particularly the ancient world is sort of my true love, really, my real passion. It's what I actually genuinely like and care about and read about completely in my own time and stuff. So
have you always been like that? As a boy, were you into history?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. Some of my most early cherished memories are in the British Museum or walking around a castle, some ruins somewhere. Absolutely. I've always been fascinated by sort of, you know, knights in armor, the medieval world, but particularly the ancient world. So at undergrad, I did what was like class civs, really. So it's like the Greek world and the Roman world. Like most guys, it transpired earlier this year, didn't it, on Twitter? It went round for a while that suddenly they realised that lots of men just think about Rome all the time. Well, that was a great vindication for me personally, because I am one of those people sort of with bells on. I genuinely do just sort of think about Rome sometimes. I'm just sitting there sort of staring into space and something about the Republic will pop into my mind. So that is genuinely me. And so hopefully this stream, I want to talk a little bit about that kind of stuff.
All right. I suppose as an entree, would you talk about the usefulness of history and why you particularly find it so exciting and interesting and always have done? Because a lot of people will say, oh, history is boring. You know, obviously it's a stupid remark, but you can understand why they say it. It's that it seems distant and detached from the life we live today. What would you say to people like that?
True stories are quite often more incredible than any fiction. Also, the present is a product of the past. To understand the present, you need an understanding of the past. It's as simple as that. Cicero, the Roman orator, said that to be ignorant of your past is to forever remain a child. I think that's true. I don't really know how people can sort of hope to understand the present without coming to grips on some level with the past. And just the stories just the stories are great. Again, ever since I was a child, I don't know how some people's imagination isn't fired by history. Since a child, I've been fascinated by the first Caesars, by the story of Alexander the Great, by some of the great kings of England, Henry V. And there's so many stories from World War I, from World War II. It's just endless. I do happen to be one of those people, probably on the far end of the spectrum, where there's very little which doesn't interest me. Something has to be extremely boring and dry, like the Chartists or something, before I actively I'm not interested. But most things, you know, stories of bloody adventure and derring do. And if they're real stories, I've just always found it fascinating. Like I say, going to the British Museum as a child, looking at sort of the mummies, you know, ancient Egypt. I don't know how people find it boring. I really don't. But there you go. That's
I think it's because, like, for me personally, I mean, I love stories. I love dramas, TV dramas and films. But with history, there's always this distance that I can't identify with the people because it's so different. It's such a different time. But I guess this is actually a product of my own ignorance because if I knew more about, I don't know, the Jacobite Rebellion, for example, there'd be facts that I would be able to, that would immediately give me a picture of the types of clothes they wore in those days, the types of diet, the expectations that they had, the type of social system they lived under. And that would enable me to get into it and to empathize with those people. And so the more you know, the easier it is to get into it, I think.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's absolutely true. I heard it said when you learn a foreign language, there's a certain tipping point where you just, a lot of it sort of fairly quickly starts making sense. Or if you're very good on an instrument, at a certain point, you can just riff, you can just play with it. You're no longer sort of watching your P's and Q's, you can just play with it. I think that's the case with sort of any knowledge. If you've got a big enough knowledge of, you know, chemistry or something, at some point, everything starts to click and work together, and then you can just start riffing with it, if you like. Same with history, I think. At a certain point, once you know how all sorts of periods link up to each other, you can start seeing parallels and things all over the place.
This is where I've always said that history teaching would be far better if they did give you a sense of the continuum rather than isolated, like focused intensely on one particular period. If they instead showed you how things linked, how the different periods link together, I think that would be far better because people could then understand, they'd have a sense of context. But anyway, you had your own things that you wanted to talk about, and that's quite extensive. So let's just get straight into that.
Just quickly to carry on that point you made, I've made a conscious effort over the years to sort of link things up in my mind. So, for example, at undergrad, I did sort of the late Republic, or most of the Republic, the age of the Caesars and the Empire, and early Christianity or late antiquity, and then I knew a fair bit anyway about sort of the early medieval period and the medieval period, but there was whole portions of sort of the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th century I knew almost nothing about. And sort of through my 20s and 30s, made a conscious effort. Edward Gibbon incidentally helped me with that. Made a conscious effort to sort of link these things up. How do you get from the fall of the Roman Empire to Charlemagne, for example? And, you know, once you are able to link those things up, even you know, in quite a low resolution way, it does really help. So,
That sounds very interesting and exciting when you say something like that. That how do you get from this thing to this very different thing? That's interesting to me. Whereas if you said, so how did we get from, let's examine a day in the life of, an artisan in Roman Britain. That's not so interesting. It's really far more about how things transform and evolve that I find fascinating personally.
One of the things that sort of a lot of history nerds do, because that's what I am really, just a fan of history. I've got an undergrad in it, but you know, I'm not published in it. I've never taught it. I'm not a doctor in it. I'm just a fan of history. But one of the things I think a lot of history fans do is sort of learn king lists, like being able to know everyone from Alfred to Charles III, being able to name all the emperors from Augustus to Honorius or something, and re-going over it, going over and over and over it again until it's sort of, you know, knowing all the presidents or something, you know. It's a bit OCD, it's a bit autistic, but if you eventually get it,
the world
there's
stop.
No parallel. It's
without autists, the world would stop rotating.
Right.
But I remember just as you reminded me of something, when I was at school, some kids, I think I had this, there was a ruler that was popular with kids at that time, and it was made of wood, and I think one side of it had the name, well, it must have been both sides of it, had the names of all the monarchs in Britain from Alfred downwards. That was quite cool.
Yeah, as a child, I had a poster of all of them from William the Conqueror down to the old Queen Elizabeth II. I was raised in a household. People who don't know, can't, maybe foreign people who don't recognise accents too well. I am very working class, you know. Grew up in a three up, two down terraced house, you know. I went to a very, very normal comprehensive school. But our household was filled with books, sort of fairly, even though we had no money. It was quite a literary family, if you like. We was all expected to go to uni and do probably humanities-based things. So from a young age, I was sort of, you know, around the dinner table or whatever. We may well talk about the kings and queens or something. So that's why it's second nature, you know, like as a child, be taken to the British Museum or to some ruins somewhere. And so, yeah, I feel like it was a no-brainer to me to do A-levels in history and ancient history and do an undergrad in something like ancient history. And I worked for sort of nearly 18-odd years in asset management in the financial services. To finally do something to make my living out of just talking about history, I mean, it's sort of a dream come true, really. But so for this stream, though, I thought we could talk about some of the lessons from history. I know you've just had Tom Survive the Jive on, and he's really great, so I won't be able to top him. He is really superb. I've had a few conversations with him myself, but hopefully I can say some interesting things about lessons from the past, because Woz, we are living in a degenerated age, don't you think? We are living in a tainted age. It's difficult not to come to that conclusion. And that our liberties, our freedoms are being eroded before our very eyes. There's some sort of active, proactive process going on to form some kind of tyranny over us, which didn't exist before. I mean, I don't know exactly your age, but I think we're about the same age, you know. Children of the 80s and 90s, and it didn't used to be like this, did it?
And no, it's getting, yeah, it's certainly getting worse all the time. When you say degenerated, what I think of is not just the loss of liberty, but also the loss of a cultural hierarchy. So that, you know, a working class family today might not know that it's actually a good idea to have books around and to take your kid to the museum. And so forth. Even middle class parents, I think, are increasingly clueless about this kind of thing, and that is what I see as the most the key sign of cultural decay and degeneration. But yeah, the loss of personal liberty is another key aspect of it. Yes,
and censorship, a creeping or perhaps not so creeping censorship, global censorship, something like that. Well, perhaps not on the global scale, but all this has happened before. Not only has it happened before, it's happened many times before. Now, I don't think history repeats, not exactly anyway, but, you know, there's that famous to the point of cliche saying by Mark Twain that history does often rhyme, though. There are nearly always parallels to be found. And that is certainly true. And so I just thought maybe we could talk a bit about some of the times what we're going through now has happened before. And if there are any lessons to be found, to be mined there. So I said, didn't I, that I, you know, my first true love is the ancient world. I want to go back to ancient Rome and talk about particularly the work of Cornelius Tacitus. Whenever I'm given an opportunity to talk about whatever I want to talk about, quite often I find myself gravitating towards Tacitus, one of my favourite, in fact, my favourite ancient historian by quite some way. But just before we do, there are sort of the obvious parallels, much more obvious, of the Bolshevik era or the Stalinist era, or even the Maoist era in China, where, you know, previously not exactly 100% free societies, but much freer societies found themselves under a socialist or a communist dictatorship.
Monstrous. Dreadful. I mean, I'm hoping that it doesn't get that bad, but I wouldn't be surprised because they have the technology.
Yeah, well, history will never really repeat, not exactly repeat. There may be rhyme, but it won't repeat exactly. I mean, we live in a world now where surveillance, someone like old Joe Stalin could only dream of the type of surveillance that our modern intelligence services enjoy. So it will always be a bit different. But nonetheless, it does seem that the sort of global elites are the sort of globalists. It's difficult to define exactly, but they are sort of crazed leftists, whether you want to call them Marxists or communists or whatever. You know, that's could do a whole stream for talk for hours just about that. But whatever they are, whoever they are, they are sort of the left. I think the whole paradigm of left and right doesn't make a great deal of sense anymore. It's outmoded. It's pretty 20th century. I think of it more now as more like globalists and non-globalists. You know, maybe in the British paradigm, those that value British or English heritage and history and existence, and those that want to destroy it. They're the two camps. It's not really left and right. It's just those that want to see us destroyed and those that don't.
I think I might write an essay next year asking, you know, what should the axis be for our times, you know, because it's a very interesting question. Left and right, we still say the left because it has some use. It has, we know what we mean in shorthand, useful shorthand. But as you say, it's not really applicable. I mean, someone like Klaus Schwab, I don't think he's a leftist. I don't think he's a communist.
Right, yeah.
But and at the same time, he does share something. I mean, he's a materialist. He clearly believes in nothing but the material. So in that sense, he's, you know, of the same ilk as communists. But yeah, he's not what you would, you know, at the same time, it's not accurate to call him a communist. So yeah, I agree. It's an interesting thing. Globalist versus nationalist is one way of looking at it. Materialist versus, something else, some sort of spiritual or religious way of looking at the world. It's a very interesting question. Sorry to interrupt.
No. So that someone like Klaus Schwab, let's say, or Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, you know, Biden, Rishi Sunak, they're not Marxist-Leninists, right? They're not Bolsheviks. They're not really, you're right, they're not a commie in the sort of 20th century sense, but yet they're sort of the left, even though I've just said, and we seem to agree that that's not really the right word for it at all. But anyway, we can look at the sort of the examples of the 20th century. There's a great book by, Frank Decotta, Mao's Great Famine, where it talks not just about the Great Leap Forward, but also the 100 Flowers Bloom period and just various oppression by the Maoist Communist Party. And there's also the various volumes of The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a really harrowing thing. I don't know if you've ever read The Gulag Archipelago books?
No, I haven't. I'm not. I used to read a lot as a child. I read voraciously, but not as an adult. And I don't really know why that is. But, I mean, on the one hand, it's an embarrassing character flaw and a failing. But at the same time, I tend to enjoy learning this stuff in the way that what we're doing right now. So it hasn't really held me back too much. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, I get by, put it that way. But no, I haven't read The Gulag Archipelago.
Well, there's many volumes to it. It's extremely long. I read a couple of volumes and then did the rest on audiobook. I'm a big, big, big believer in audiobooks. I've never actually done an advert for Audible, but I totally would. And lots of this stuff's on YouTube as well for free, read by LibriVox. It's in the public domain. I do advise people, if you can stomach it, to read or listen to The Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, because there really are some lessons there. I mean, it is the mid-20th century, the Stalinist period, but there's lots there to sort of tell you what their modus operandi is, how they deal with people. But it really is sort of, The Gulag Archipelago is sort of relentlessly dark. He was put in prison as a political prisoner, Zekts, as they call them, and put out into a gulag, a prison in the sort of open steppe in Russia, and it's just sort of an endless stream of horror, really. But I hope that the 21st century West isn't headed for anything nearly as bad as sort of the Stalinist era. But who knows? I mean, really, who knows? It is getting pretty scary in some places, but beyond that, beyond sort of Stalin and Mao, which are probably our best examples and lessons in history to look back on, how our future might go, how this sort of creeping censorship and a tyranny, the best I can call it, creeping tyranny that you're not allowed to question the message. You know?
Oh, well, we saw, I mean, obviously COVID, I think, epitomized this, where there is a line and every organ of society is spouting that line and everything else is disinformation and fake news. Quite amazing at the time when it all came out, and it was all so harmonized, so unified.
Mm. Yeah, some kind of global despotism at play there, it seemed to me. I'm completely aghast by that, by the inquiry they just recently had about the lockdowns. That it was all about, why didn't you do it harder and quicker? There was not that I saw really any discussion about the massive power grab by government and the curtails of our civil liberties.
Yeah.
To put whole nations under a type of house arrest for years on end.
It's absolutely unprecedented.
Woes, that's unprecedented in human history. They didn't do that during the Black Death of the 14th century. Incredible.
But that inquiry, the point of it really is certainly not to investigate what really happened and what was really going on behind the scenes. The point of it is to ratify the decisions that were made, broadly speaking. Mm. And really, the way, as you say, the way to do that is to say that these decisions weren't extreme enough. It should have been even more. It should have been even worse than it was. Mm-hmm. So we've got to work out why it wasn't. Why did Boris, why was he asleep at the wheel when he should have been implementing tyranny in March rather than in May or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely sort of sickening and a bit terrifying to me that's how they're dealing with it after the fact. There are sort of global elites, or at least Western elites. You know, it's not every country in the world, but, you know, we saw how badly Australia and New Zealand fell for it. And, you know, countries like Sweden, perhaps slightly less so. But anyway, there's some sort of despotism, shall we say, some sort of tyranny in waiting. Well, like I say, this has happened before. And all the things that go with it, the sort of the doublethink, the liars, the hypocrisies, the sort of in-your-face humiliations that go along with it all. This descent into slavery, actually, a type of slavery. Of course, there are many shades of slavery. Sometimes when you say that word, people immediately think of the cotton-picking South type slavery. But there are many, many forms and degrees of slavery. One where, for example, you have no political voice left to you, no release valve in any way.
Imagine trying to protest the lockdown at the time. I mean, you could only do it by going out. If you try to get your politician, your local MP, to ask a question in Parliament or something, it would be completely futile, because he wouldn't do it. He would say, well, no one else is asking for this. and then the most he would do is some casual mention in the comments. So you really wouldn't stand a chance. And people didn't. I mean, the thing rolled on regardless of their objections. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, yeah, we were enslaved. I mean, we didn't have a say in the matter, basically. Mm.
Mm. Well, look at what happened when Boris left, and they put that woman in. I can't even remember her name now.
Who was that Liz Prime Truss.
Minister? Liz Truss. Sorry, I can't even remember her name. And you know, the powers that be decided she wasn't their woman, and there was sort of a bloodless legal coup d'état to put that Rishi fella in, that cuckoo in the nest, that puppet. That shill for God knows who. I mean, that's so, yeah, we're under a type of political, perhaps slavery is a bit much, but you can see the trend at least towards that. Well, as I keep saying, this sort of thing has happened before. And perhaps the example par excellence from the ancient world is when the Roman Republic slid into a monarchy, into an empire. When there was, at one point, at least if you believe the accounts, a free Roman Republic, which had a democracy. And then you end up with emperors that are as autocratic and bloodthirsty as is possible. People like Caligula or Nero, for example, or Domitian. And that process... was quite well documented, well, it was very well documented at the time, but even to us into the modern period, survive a fair amount of literary accounts of that period. The ancient historians, the ancient Roman historians. And that is the thing, or one of the things I studied at undergrad. And it's one of the things that I've kept rereading throughout my whole adult life, sort of can't stop in a way. Again, a little bit of, I don't know, very, very, very mild autism. But there's certain things, being a history nerd, that I just keep going back to again and again. I can't help it. The campaigns of Henry V, say, the campaigns of Wellington in Spain, at the story of Alexander. One of the things are that the first 12 Caesars, it's sort of fascinating. Most people that are interested in Rome can't help but gravitate towards the end of the Republic, the days of Crassus and Pompey and Caesar and Octavian, Augustus, Mark Antony, Lepidus, the second triumvirate, and on into the Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, and so on and so on. That sort of, because also, as I've just mentioned, it is very well documented. We've got, there's the likes of, what, you've got like Polybius, Livy, Cassius Dio, Suetonius, Tacitus, Plutarch. There's quite a lot. You know, you've even got people like Juvenal and Ovid, poets, Virgil, you know, Strabo. There's also these people you can buy in Penguin paperback today, or you can find their audiobooks somewhere. And it's a voice, that their voice is speaking from the age of Christ or from the first century. It's quite remarkable to me. Again, I don't know how people find it boring. that someone's speaking to you from the ancient Roman world. I find it more than interesting. It's fascinating. And anyway, of these ancient historians, the one which is sort of, to my mind, fantastically prescient is Tacitus. If anyone knows their history out there, they will have heard of Tacitus and know Tacitus. If I can bring that name and some of this knowledge to even one person who's never heard of it before, I'll feel myself privileged. I do advise anyone out there that is interested in Roman history, start with Tacitus. So a little bit about him and his works before I talk about what he actually said. Is that okay? All right.
Yes, well, go for it. Just introduce him briefly first. Tacitus is a Roman historian. Aren't there quotes from him about Britain? I'm sure there are.
Yeah. He wrote that there's four main books that he wrote. Two are just straight up histories, the annals and the histories. And there are two much shorter ones, one called the Germania, which is all about Germany, and one called Agricola, which is all about ancient Britain. Again, if you're interested in Roman-era Britain, read Tacitus's Agricola or listen to the audio, someone reading the audio book. It's not even long. The Germania and the Agricola are fairly short. Agricola was his father-in-law, who was Roman governor of Britain in the first century AD. And he wrote a book all about the life of his father-in-law. It's a bit of a hagiography, but he paints a picture of first century AD Britain. And, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. But the main two books, and if you're German, you must read the Germania. You must. I'm not asking. But the two big tomes he wrote are the Annals and the Histories. And the Annals runs from the death of Augustus through to Nero, the end of Nero. And the Histories runs from Nero and the year of the four emperors through to, we think, probably would have gone up to the age of Trajan, in which he lived, which is sort of 100, 110 AD. But there's big chunks of it that are lost, that are missing. So, for example, in the Annals, the whole bit about Caligula is missing. In the Histories, most of it is missing. We've only really got the first six books. So we've got lots and lots of information about, for example, Tiberius and most of Claudius and Nero, the year of the four emperors, and a bit about Vespasian, tiny bit about Domitian, and loads of things about Nerva and Trajan is missing. However, there's still loads there, hours worth of audiobook, for example. And now, the content of what you said. It really is unbelievably prescient, because a lot of these emperors were censorious and tyrannical. And the things he lived through and it described are the things we're living through right now in the 21st century. He gives us lessons about what it was like, because he lived through it. He lived through a period of censorious tyranny into an age where he had the freedom to say and write within reason whatever he wanted again, so he could reflect on it. And it is truly remarkable, really, that someone that the same human experiences played out 2,000 years ago, or the best part of 2,000 years ago, the exact same things.
See, this is why it amazes me when lefties say there's no such thing as human nature. You know, people are shaped by their society, the age they live in. It seems to me that human nature is very consistent. You know, there have always been men jealous of rivals and competing against each other, plotting against each other, sabotaging, collaborating, rescuing each other, and pursuing women in one way or another, sometimes honorably, sometimes not. There have always been women being coy, sometimes women being slutty. It's the same stuff over and over. And by that, I don't mean to deny that times change and people are affected by the age they live in. I don't mean to say that, you know, Romans were just like us. because that's a silly thing to see. But the core human nature, the drives that emerge from it, are clearly the same as they've always been.
Yeah, there's a funny tension there between we're exactly the same as them and we're nothing like them. The idea, for example, that the past is a foreign country, things were done differently there, but not were they done differently, they were completely alien to us. And though also at the same time, lots of things are exactly the same. The nature of power, the dynamic of power is kind of exactly the same. Yeah, the relationships between men and women in all sorts of ways, exactly the same. And we'll, until we become cyborgs or something, we'll remain the same. That's one of the things is, it's just a history geek, is to imagine, I do this a lot, if you were to somehow quantum leap back in time to the Tudor period, say, or ancient Rome, classical Rome or something, what things would be sort of exactly the same and what would be unbelievably surprising at how completely different they are? So just one little example, the fact that you sort of bake bread and eat bread, for example, just one example off the top of my head, it would have to be exactly the same. Bakeries, for example, you know, it's exactly the same. A man trying to seduce or chat up a woman, it's sort of exactly the same. But then, you know, the fact that, just a small thing, the fact that, of course, they had no lighting, no electric powered lighting. So if you weren't rich enough to have candles or tallow candles or anything, then when the sun goes down, your world is dark. That's sort of a bit of an alien thing to us, isn't it?
It certainly is. I'm surrounded by God knows how many artificial lights right now. So, it's unimaginable.
Well, the idea, for example, that you have to pay very close attention and your whole life, your whole world is kind of dictated by the seasons. That's one of the things that we moderns in the West, anyway, have lost. It doesn't make any real difference what season we're in, right? We can go to Tesco's and buy pineapples and strawberries all year round or something. It's like it doesn't matter what season it is, you know, for example. Whereas it would have really, really mattered in the ancient world or the pre-modern world. So anyway, Tacitus and his sort of musings on power. So first of all, then, to say a bit about, start with the annals. So the story, really, of how Rome lost its liberties, how it sort of descended into an autocracy, how they did away with a republic and had an imperial system and a royal family, which was passed down through families. A whole suite of powers was passed down to people, which is sort of completely at odds with a republican constitution. So just a quick word before I talk about the age of Augustus and Tiberius, which is where Tacitus sort of picks up. You've got the Roman Republic. At first, there were kings long, long ago in the 700s BC. Rome was ruled by kings, but then they had a republic. And pardon me. The first chinks, this is all quite an overview, just a very, 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 fairly low resolution overview. The first chinks in their republic, most historians sort of say, showed up in sort of the 2nd century BC with the advent of the Gracchi brothers. There were these two brothers, Tiberius Gracchus and his younger brother, Gaius Gracchus. And they sort of realized that, I won't bore you with any of the sort of political details and things, but they sort of realized that you could kind of subvert the Roman political system in a specific way and sort of bypass the elites, the senatorial order, if you wanted to. And the elites, the deep state, that's a horrible anachronism. But the ancient Roman deep state didn't like that. So they clubbed them to death. They clubbed them in separate incidents and all their followers into a big bag of bones and threw those bones in the Tiber River. So the Gracchi brothers did not get away with their attempts to subvert the Roman Republic. However, over 100 years or more and more chinks in the Roman Republic until you end up with the days of when military commanders realized that if they paid the Roman military themselves, the legions would be loyal to them rather than to the state. And then you get the age of sort of Marius and Sulla, and then later Pompey and Caesar, where the men followed them. They weren't loyal to Rome. They weren't loyal to the Senate and the people of Rome. They were loyal to Pompey. They were loyal to Caesar. So if Caesar told them to march on Rome or burn down the Forum or something, they'd do it. So some parallels there with the United States, because, of course, the United States is the preeminent republic of our age, isn't it? And there's various chinks in that, isn't it? The Constitution is under attack in all sorts of ways. Some people have made parallels. But, oh, sorry, you can say something?
Well, why did the Gracchi brothers want to subvert it? I think that would be a key question here.
Yeah, no, good question. Well, a little bit boring to do with land reforms. But I suppose the main thing to say is that the senatorial elite were capricious, and they were taking the absolute mickey out of the people. They were buying up huge amounts of land and estates, dispossessing ordinary people and exploiting ordinary people in sort of a fairly grand way, treating the people, the plebs, the urban plebs of Rome, as though they were scum. And the ordinary people didn't like that, obviously. And so the Gracchi were sort of populists. Again, it's an anachronism. It's sort of putting a modern word on an ancient thing. And they're not populists in the sort of 19th, 20th century sense of that word. But nonetheless, they were sort of champions of the ordinary people, or styled themselves.
You can imagine that's how Netflix would do it. They tend to have them looking like Nigel Farage or something.
Yeah. There was all sorts of social tensions. The social wars of Rome. And when you end up with the sort of the death of the Republic with Julius Caesar and his grandnephew or adopted son, Augustus, you see all these tensions finally sort of boiling over to the point where the Republic just could not survive any longer. There are just too many tensions there.
Do you think that we are approaching a similar situation now where there are just too many tensions the system can't withhold anymore?
In the United States? Yeah, I mean,
some
people have made parallels, because we're not a republic, but I'll get on to Britain in a bit later. Because what Tacitus says in detail applies to the whole world, certainly the West. But in the United States, people have drawn parallels between the Gracchi brothers and the Kennedy brothers, who were both not exactly populists, but they were set themselves up at odds with sort of the deep state or various moneyed interests, various power factions.
Shadowy cabals.
They both found themselves murdered, didn't they? So historians have noticed a parallel between the Gracchi and the Kennedys. But we live in a more accelerated age. So whereas it took well over a century between the Gracchi and Augustus, the first Roman emperor, it's only been a few decades between the Kennedys and what we're seeing happen now. some people have said that the American Republic has had problems going back even further than that, that someone like Woodrow Wilson, that set up the Federal Reserve, sort of dished the United States some sort of death wound there, that there was sort of the kernel of its death there. Some people said that in the age of Eisenhower or Truman and Eisenhower, or FDR, Truman and Eisenhower, when they set up the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower called it, that there something died there. Some people say that Nixon going off the gold reserve. Some people say that George Bush Jr. W. with the Patriot Act. Some people have said that,
And then, the original Barack Obama with all the subverted.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, Obama with all the phone hacking, all that that was going on. Was it the NS? I think it's the NSI.
The NSI?
That was quite amazing invasions, denigrations of the idea of privacy and so on in America. But the Patriot Act, I remember at the time, people were outraged about it. That got completely absorbed, and that's now the standard. That was the war on terror. And now they seem to be reviving that yet again. So for even more attacks on rights and privacy, it just goes on and on.
Yeah, it seems to me, I don't think I'm paranoid or being a conspiracy theorist. It seems to me that the NSA, the intelligence services, sort of listen to absolutely everything. It's not that there's a guy sitting somewhere in Virginia listening, literally listening to everything. It's just that there'll be some sort of surveillance looking out for keywords or whatever. It seems that there is some sort of global surveillance thing going on. I mean, again, I'm not being paranoid, and the vast majority of people live extremely boring lives and got nothing to worry about. But that's not the point, right? That's not the point. The point is that there never used to be this thing, this sort of monolith, watching everyone, and now there is. Anyway, yeah, the Patriot Act after 9/11 is that we sort of need to be able to spy on everyone at all times to make sure 9/11, a new 9/11 doesn't happen, and it's only temporary. Like Dick Cheney and people say, it's only temporary, and we'll renew it every year or every few years. And once we don't need it anymore, we'll get rid of it. Of course, they never got rid of it. And now it's just, it's just the new norm. So going back to Rome and Tacitus. In the Roman example, is eventually the military, and a lot of the intelligence services are military intelligence. You know, MI5, MI6, CIA, it's military intelligence. It's what it is. But in the example of Rome, you get a point where the center, if you like, the Senate, whether it's the US Senate or the Roman Senate, the Senate is no longer the cockpit of power. The true nexus of power is somewhere else, sitting with someone else or other people. You may still have a legislature which goes through the motions of appearing to make or repeal laws, but actually the real power is somewhere else. It's with the military. Now, finally, with Rome, you get rival generals that are ambitious. There's another way of putting it. They sort of want to or feel they need to install themselves as an autocrat, as the top dog. Now, you've got someone like Marius or Sulla, and then later Caesar that does that. Caesar wasn't the first man to march on Rome. Now, I think that we're somewhere just before that period now in the United States. You saw with Biden's inauguration that the streets of D.C. were flooded with troops.
That was incredible. Indeed. The White House it looked like an authoritarian state where the power, the president, it needs to protect himself from the public because there's a widespread understanding that the public hate him and would kill him if they could get near him. That's how it looked. And I'm not saying that that's the reality, but it's how it looked. There was definitely a sense of huge mistrust of the public by the powers that be.
And if you look at the January 6th incident, which of course has been what really happened that day seems to have been completely perverted out of all recognition as to what really happened by the Democrats. But you look at in the Roman example, the Forum in Rome, the Senate House and the Forum, which is roughly analogous to sort of Washington, D.C., and the White House and the Capitol building and things, very, very, very roughly analogous. In the end, mobs did burn it down. because the various dictators, wannabe dictators, the various power factions were out of control, or popular ones got assassinated, and their faction, their mob, come and burn it down.
See, now, I wonder if that happened now, would that actually change anything? Because power is not, I mean, it doesn't live in that building. So if you destroy that building, the power doesn't, you know, die. It doesn't work like that. I understand why people destroy buildings. What I don't understand is why it's ever had any effect. Because I don't think it would have much effect now. If if some terrorists, let's not say terrorists, an insurgency within the American public were to storm and demolish the White House, I don't think the American state would just take that and say, "Oh well, the White House is gone. Were defeated." I think they would just crush the insurgency with their ruthless efficiency, and nothing would change. Maybe I'm naive about this. I just don't really understand why destroying a building actually changes anything.
No, you're absolutely right. When the Forum in Rome was burnt down, for example, for the first time, more than once, it didn't change the power dynamic. In fact, it made the various factions even more entrenched, even more inflamed than they were before. So you're right. Burning down a building doesn't necessarily change anything at all. Well, it will change things, of course, but it doesn't solve anything, let's put it that way. No, you're absolutely right. The reason why I mentioned January 6th is because, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, there was no such thing as they weren't trying to destroy the Capitol building, were they? It wasn't a new Pearl Harbor event. These weren't crazed maniacs trying to subvert the Republic, trying to destroy the Republic. That's not what was happening on January 6th, right? But that's the narrative that the Democrats, and that's Kamala Harris's fever dream, isn't it? That is what was happening.
Oh, yeah, that it was an insurrection and they meant to...
An insurrection, yeah.
Yeah, take over the government, and if politicians had been there, they would have killed them. I don't really know how far she would go in stating this, but yeah, the idea is that they were wanting to destroy everything. And they clearly didn't. I mean, I think they didn't really know what they were doing. It seemed like they thought they got carried away. They thought it would be funny. They thought it would be fun. They thought it would be exciting, an adventure, and it would make a statement. Mm. You know, I think that was actually the extent of their ambitions, most of them. I don't think anyone there actually thought, we're going to take over the country by doing this.
No, of course not. That guy with the big hat, the balls, like that's funny to me. He's a funny guy. Like, could it have been more gentle? A guy breaks into Nancy Pelosi's office and puts his feet up on her desk. Could that be any more gentle, really, than that? As an insurrection, it wasn't.
Yeah,
an insurrection,
yeah. Exactly. It's like a stag night that's gone a bit glamorous.
The only reason I mentioned January 6th at all is to say that if and when we did get to a point with the Roman parallels here, if we did get to a point where there genuinely was a mob that wanted to burn down the White House or the Capitol building or something, we're at the very first, you could say January 6th was like, you know, 0.01% towards that, on that trajectory, right? It's on that trajectory. I don't think it wasn't an insurrection. It was nothing of the sort. In fact, it was probably, you know, all egged on by the FBI or whatever. But anyway, let's not get into that. What I'm saying is where we are in the parallel with Rome, we're getting towards, I fear, a point where the military, the politicians, just sort of now overtly using the military as a tool against the people. Sorry, I thought you were going to say something.
No. I was okay. Listening. I think they're pretty much doing that already. I mean, I think
But not that overtly, right? Not yet.
Not yet, but with Charlottesville, for example, you had the crowds, the Unite the Right protesters, hoping to bond with the police. And the police responded by showing that we're absolutely not on your side. We don't identify with you. We won't be kind to you. And we will corral you into an encounter with Antifa. And that's what they did. It's right. Total betrayal in that sense of, you know, loyal conservative Americans who have supported the police all their lives. So I think the police, I mean, you know, I'm sure that there are police all over America and Britain who have doubts. And you hear about them now again. They're rooted out. They're like, just recently, there were that band of retired police officers in Britain who were found saying racist things on WhatsApp. I mean, that doesn't mean that they're against the whole country, but it does suggest they're going to be, they're more likely to be rebellious. And so they get rooted out now and then. People with explicit dislike of the way things are, they get identified and they get ousted. So I think that there will be on both sides of the Atlantic police who don't like the way things are. I think a lot of them just are basically for hire. I mean, they are thinking of their pensions, their salaries, and their families. And so they will side with, they will do whatever the power tells them to do and arrest whoever and beat whoever the power tells them to beat.
Absolutely. The police are basically the enforcement arm for the state. Of course. Yeah, absolutely. They don't really, maybe the odd individual rural bobby might be sort of very humane, but as a general rule, the police are there to sort of enforce the status quo. And when the status quo, or when the message, the underlying political agenda is one that is aiming towards a tyranny or a despotism of some type, well, then you're in trouble. Now the parallels with Rome really become clear, because if you look at, say, obviously it's COVID is a good example in Australia and New Zealand and Britain. But if you look at, say, the way there's examples where the FBI have been extremely politically partisan, even the Joint Chiefs of Staff seem to be politically partisan. If you look at Homeland Security, how they seem to, or the open borders thing, or the replacement theory, in inverted commas theory, the whole agenda for replacement in the West. You can see that there's something extremely sinister going on. And going hand in hand with that is a program of censorship. If you dare to notice or talk about that you've noticed, then you're a political enemy, a pariah. You've become a problem for the state and the police and the army, ultimately.
And they had a system for dealing with you. And then I genuinely think that Elon Musk has thrown a spanner in that. It's a problem that a lot of people, that the whole atmosphere on Twitter is now much less censorious. So people are saying things that they simply wouldn't have been able to say a year ago or 2 years ago. And so I really wonder what the hell they're going to do with Elon Musk. I wouldn't be surprised if they take drastic action against him at some point.
Good King Elon saved every one of us. I wonder what they'll do with Trump. I saw just recently, was it last week, he did a little speech, or I saw it on Twitter, where he said, I'm going to dismantle, he said it before, didn't he? He said he's going to drain the swamp before. He didn't do much draining, actually, did he? But anyway, this time he says he's going to dismantle various elements, within the FBI and the CIA and things, and do away with having no term limits in Congress and the Senate, and all sorts of sort of fairly, I hesitate to say radical, but fairly radical things he says he's going to do this time, should he be re-elected. I wonder what they'll do with that, because Jack Kennedy said he was going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the wind, and he got his brains blown out in front of everyone. So I do worry a little bit for the likes of Trump and Elon, if and when the intelligence services decide enough is enough. But we'll see. We'll see on that. Let's go back to Tacitus and Rome. When the Republic did finally crumble and fall apart, the first emperor was Augustus, and he became emperor when he was quite young. He sort of started the process when he was about 19 and finally finished all his civil wars when he was about, I think, 27 odd. So still quite a young man, really. And the way he did it was to sort of pretend that he wasn't an autocratic warlord, sort of pretend that the Republic still existed and that you can still vote for your consuls and your praetors, and we'll still go through all the motions of having a republic.
See, I'm thinking of Tony Blair, where it's ostensibly a democracy, but really he gets everything he wants. You know,
right.
Apparently he wanted war with Iraq. He was obsessed with it from 1998 onwards, and then 5 years later they came up with the pretext for it. to interrupt.
Yeah, no. I mean, just you say the war in Iraq. Did you say?
Yeah.
Well, that's an American. Yeah, the Axis of Evil has been kicking around the Pentagon for decades. Ever since George Bush Senior failed to take out Saddam in 1991, the Pentagon has wanted to get him. Absolutely, the America has despised North Korea since the 50s. They've despised Iran since the 70s, since the Islamic Revolution, or before even. So that didn't come out of nowhere. The Axis of Evil absolutely did not come out of nowhere. Anyway, that's a bit of an aside. When you have a uniparty type setup, like you've got in the United States, or you could argue in Britain, that all the parties are basically controlled by, if you look at Rishi and being a puppet of Westminster, okay, you're now looking at, or rather, you're no longer looking at an open democratic process in any way. It doesn't matter who you vote for. They're not going to represent your views in any way. Okay, so with Augustus, everyone knew that the power, again, the cockpit of power, should we say, lie with him. But yet, people sort of accepted the despotism because he sort of allowed them to pretend they weren't slaves anymore, right? They were now effectively a type of slave, but people could live with the fiction because he didn't flaunt it. He didn't flaunt his power. He would even pretend to go back to the Senate and say, I don't want the powers anymore. And of course, as sycophants, they would re-bestow them on him. Now, when he died, and that's a very delicate balancing act, isn't it? There's all sorts of hypocrisy, crazy hypocrisy involved in that. And one man might be able to sort of hold that together, that pretense, while he lived, if he's a very, very, very deft politician, as Octavian was, or Augustus was. But when he died, it sort of very nakedly passed down to his adopted son, Tiberius. And the only way that really worked was that Tiberius would flooded the Forum and the Senate House with soldiers. And the Senate, the people, the powers that be sort of knew the deal. They knew what was going on. So, you know, I wonder if something like that, something along those lines, might happen in the next few decades at some point. At some point in the next few decades in the United States, or maybe not just in the United States, in Britain somewhere, one particular party, one particular faction, one particular power decides that it's just going to sort of fairly nakedly retain power by using the military or the police or just the police. Who knows, you know? If you look at the Bolsheviks in 1917, they just nakedly use force to basically seize the main buildings in Moscow, in St. Petersburg. You know, it's sort of as simple as that. We're in control now. You've got to wrestle it back from our cold, dead hands now, right? This story has played out many, many, many times in history. Many, many times in history. You know, Mao in, was it 49? Mao comes to power in 49. You know, the vast majority of Chinese people weren't party members, weren't communists. But the cockpit of power is with him now in Beijing. He's going to steal, by force, all the power. And if you don't physically stop him, that's the ball game. Okay, this story has played out over and over and over and over again. I see it in our future, perhaps even our fairly near future, that, you know, some populist, you know, whether it's Trump or Farage or God knows who in decades to come, people that are children or maybe even not yet born, true populists, Gracchi brothers of the future, win power for themselves and are physically prevented from taking it. We're on that trajectory.
Yeah, that would be the question. Would they be prevented? And would it work, or, you know, to seize a building? Or would it be, as I said earlier, the building doesn't actually matter? That the state isn't going to accept that you're in charge now just because you've seized that building. It might just bomb the building itself just to kill you. Who knows? But I can certainly see that. I don't find that implausible and, you know, outlandish in the way that it would have seemed 10 years ago or 15. Certainly when I was a child, this kind of thing would just completely unthinkable, really. Now it seems much more, well, the tensions, the stakes are high, the tensions are high, and the antagonism, the resentment, it's all over the place. There are all these different groups who I could imagine doing this. And of course, you've got the ethnic tensions, especially in Western European countries, but in America as well. Any one of those ethnic groups could decide, fuck it, let's just take over. Let's just take control. So that would be a source of solidarity, or political groups. I could see all of this stuff seems plausible to me. The only question would be, would they succeed or not? Is it, that's much less, much less clear cut, because the state, who knows what it could do, or what it would be prepared to do in defense of the status quo. I do think that in Western European countries, anyone attempting something like this would have to be very aware that you might win within the arena of your own country, Sweden, Belgium, whatever. You might win. And then America just swoops in with a nuke to put things back to normal, so to speak, to install a new regime.
Mm. Well, that's why I've mentioned the army a fair bit here, the military, or the police. You could say the police, actually, because you talked about, well, you could win, you could seize the building, you could win an election, and you're now in the building, your parliament, wherever you are in the world, your Senate House, your forum, whatever it is, your chancellery, you could win. But if the police and or the army aren't on your side, it's not going to count for ultimately, it's not going to be enough, right? Say like someone like Geert Wilders or something. Well, if the army decides they're going to just, you know, not allow him to form a government or something, or someone like Trump gets in and he finds himself on the receiving end of an assassin's bullet. Right. So that's why I've been talking about the army a bit, because ultimately, power rests with who could. Well, let's take the example of the English Civil War of the 1640s, 50s and 60s, the age of Charles II and Oliver Cromwell. I won't go into too much or much detail, but obviously a power struggle between Parliament and the Crown. There's Civil War, a short-lived Second Civil War, Parliament wins it. But then there's a power struggle between Parliament and the army. And in that struggle, there's no struggle. The army wins. The guy that controls the army, Oliver Cromwell, he'll just dissolve Parliament then. The king tried that. We'll have a war against him, beat him. Parliament's then doing what the army doesn't want. Well, the army will dissolve Parliament then. The power's with who's got the force.
Yes.
Yes. That is the ultimate...
That's the point that I was making just now, is that America has the force. Whatever force you have, America's got the military. It's got the God knows what weaponry and can always intervene. And I guess it would depend on what was in it for America to intervene, to make sure that Sweden doesn't go monarchist or something like that. I don't know.
I mean, it's sort of making it a bit more complicated to talk about America going around the world and doing these things, although, you know, there are examples of that. But just if we just talk about just America, or just the British army in Britain, or just the Swedish army in Sweden, say, to make it a bit more simple, or the Roman army in ancient Rome, you know, whoever controls that, the buck stops there, right? And so with ancient Rome, the Caesars, in the first instance, the Julio-Claudian family, and all subsequent emperors, they were imperators. They were the head of the army as well. So if the politicians ever sort of stopped playing ball or got ideas above their station, ultimately the city could be flooded with soldiers.
And isn't that the American system, where the president is also the commander in chief?
Yeah, right. So say Biden claims, say Trump wins, and Biden claims that it was a fake. There was all sorts of problems with the election, and that in fact, no, he's not going to give up power. And if Trump's team want to come into the White House for a transition, well, the Marines are going to stop that. That's not that crazy of a scenario.
No, not anymore. I don't find that. Yeah, I think it would be naive to say that that's an outlandish and improbable scenario.
And it might not happen in 2024, but it might happen in the 2030s or 40s or 50s at some point. All I'm saying is that we're on a trajectory, a very similar trajectory.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Many, many times.
I wouldn't be surprised if it happened in 2024. It doesn't seem incredibly outlandish to me.
Well, he flooded DC with troops in 2020, didn't he? I mean, that was extremely worrying. I'm not exaggerating. I was extremely concerned to see that. Never seen that before. I don't think it's ever happened before. Perhaps in the age of Lincoln, but anyway, in recent times, in the 20th century, nothing like that has ever happened. I've got a few quotes here from Tacitus when he talks about the various tyrannies of Tiberius, Caligula, the various crimes, because going along with sort of the naked seizure of power, we'll have to go all sorts of other crimes of censorship to sort of cover up the double standards, the hypocrisy there. And there's all sorts of parallels with, again, what we see today. You have to bring in, along with censorship, there'll be stricter treason laws. You see the way they dealt with the January 6th guys, treating them as though they're insurrectionists.
Yes.
As though they're guilty of treason in some way.
Yeah.
You quite often get in the age, well, you started in the age of Tiberius and then into Caligula, and it sort of went off the charts in the age of Nero. You get an informer society where everyone's looking over their shoulders. You've got it in the Bolshevik era and obviously went absolutely through the roof under Stalin. In Maoist China, you have a type of informer society where there's sort of a virtue spiral. Everyone, even kids, quite often... kids actually telling the authorities on everyone, and everyone's looking over your shoulder. You no longer trust your neighbor, you no longer trust even members of your own family, and the very fabric of a civil society, a free civil society, falls apart. And it can happen very, very, very quickly. It can happen very quickly, almost overnight. sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find that implausible. And I think we've seen both, we've seen people riled up. So the left at this point, are, I mean, remember that infamous clip of the SJW in 2016 screaming as Trump was inaugurated, 2017. And they're also highly politicized in terms of, you know, the whole white, anti-white thing. I don't find it terribly implausible to imagine them, you know, being directed to just kill Republicans or whatever. That, I don't know. Maybe maybe I'm more burnt out than I should be. But that just doesn't seem outlandish.
In Rome, you ended up with sort of mob rules. People like Milo, not the modern Milo. There's an ancient Roman Milo, having mob wars in the streets. Well, what was the BLM riots? What was that summer, if not a political mob? That's what that was. The lawlessness in all sorts of American cities, the increasing lawlessness in our cities.
Yeah. Who is allowed to get away with doing stuff and who is not allowed to get away with doing the same stuff? That's also an important thing here, because it sets the tone. It shows this group of people that you are screwed, and it shows this group of people you're okay, don't worry. On your side.
And one thing I just wanted to say, Woes, is how long do you think I've got left? Because I could talk about this shit for hours on, literally hours on end, but I know we're on
20 or 30 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. We get up to quarter to midnight.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. Okay, great. All right. Well, here's one quote from Tacitus, Cornelius Tacitus. And it could be talking about today. And he's talking about the way in which, the nature in which the Roman people sort of sleepwalked themselves into slavery, a type of political slavery. Talking about the power elites of his day, he said, quote, "A shocking crime was committed on the unscrupulous initiative of a few individuals, with the blessing of more and amid the passive acquiescence of all." I find that an incredible quote that is 2,000 years old and from ancient Rome.
Yeah.
It could be talking about sort of what the Democrats and the WEF and such power groups are doing. So there's a very small number of unscrupulous individuals. And there's a bigger group of them egging them on, hoping that they get their dream of dominance, whilst the vast majority of people just passively sort of watch it happen in front of their very eyes.
Spectators to history, even as it affects them, even as they take part in it. They don't really have any agency. And I think this, again, is one of the things that a lot of us have learned for the first time in recent years, that most 90-95% of people are like that.
Well, we live in a fairly decadent, a fairly soft age, don't we? We've been deracinated very deliberately in all sorts of ways. And some historians have called the era we live in a long peace, or the long peace. Since World War II, men have not been expected to fight particularly, have we? You and I certainly...
No, it's certainly not in the culture that every man should be a soldier, anything like that.
That you have to do national service, or that it's just in the future that you're probably going to have to fight in some kind of war. Okay, now the knowledge, the sure thing that that's not in your future can and does sort of, again, parallels of this in history has happened again and again, makes for softer people, softer men, right? If you throw on top of that luxury, and in the 21st century, late 20th century, early 21st century, we enjoy an absolutely unparalleled level of luxury in the West, certainly. Unbelievable, really. The fact that you never go hungry and cold, right? The fact that you can sort of get whatever you want within reason, Yeah, I mean, it's just
In terms of sensations, we've never had it. Like, you can listen to any song, watch any film, eat just about any food. Incredible range of options there.
Yeah, endlessly smoke and eat yourself to death.
Yeah, yeah.
Just the absolute avalanche of porn, all sorts of decadent luxury, right? Throw that on the top, the fact that you're never going to be asked to fight. And, it leads for sort of deracinated people. Now, the Rome of the 1st century AD and 1st century BC sort of suffered from the same sort of thing, a type of luxury, which is corrupting. It's wealth and decadence is corrupting. Tacitus said this, quote, "Step by step, they, the Roman people, were led to things which disposed towards vice, the lounge, the bath, the eloquent banquet. All this in their ignorance they called civilization when it was but part of their servitude," end quote. Again, to me, it's actually a remarkable thing that nothing has changed. In those terms, nothing has changed. It's exactly the same as it was in ancient Rome. And that a man saw it and wrote it down, and it survived to us to this day. You can find a LibriVox copy or a Penguin paperback copy of it.
It's amazing because he mentions civilization and luxury, and the two things at the same time. And civilization does mean a lot of things which are luxurious, are not necessary, are gratuitous. And luxury itself is a treat. It makes you feel important, I guess, especially back then. But actually it means that you're effectively like a baby, because you need all these things. You've come to expect and want and need these things. So you're actually more helpless and spoiled and much less self-sufficient.
Mm.
So it's kind of the opposite. Yeah, the barbarian in that sense is more able and self-sufficient and resilient than the sophisticated.
And people will not give it up. They don't want to give it up. Why would I give up my extremely easy, pampered, peaceful, middle-class life? For what? To stand up against a despotism, which I've got no hope of dismantling. They won't do it. Yeah. And so you live through the tyrannies of people like Caligula and Nero, absolutely insane tyrannies, where anything goes, including mass slaughters and things. And no one basically does anything about it. There aren't coup d'etats. There aren't massive mobs in the streets doing anything about it because they don't want to give up their wealth and luxury and peace.
And was this the origin of the phrase bread and circuses?
That's from the age of from a slightly earlier age in the Republic, but the point of that is that you that the people are kept in their place by having their bellies full and being entertained, being distracted by entertainments, the circus. Yeah.
See, it's ironic because obviously all this struggle to gain resources, to build systems, to secure safety and all that struggle, that you would hope that at the end of it there is a reward, but the reward then poisons and weakens you almost immediately. Mm. So then you become vulnerable again.
So I mentioned Caligula and Nero there. Nero is, again, sort of shorthand or a byword for one of the worst tyrannies there's ever been. But Tacitus himself lived through the age of an emperor, the last Flavian emperor, Domitian. He wasn't as bloodthirsty and as outright sadistic as Caligula or Nero, but he was a tyrant and he was very censorious, and there was lots of treason trials and lots of censorship and an informal society, and that he needed strong, proud men to be beaten down or silenced. Okay. And Tacitus lived through that. In fact, his career, his early career, was living through all of that, about 15 years of it. And he kept his head down. He kept quiet. And he actually did quite well out of it. He became a praetor and then a consul. He became one of the most powerful politicians in Rome, albeit on paper, the true power lie in the imperial palace by that point. Nevertheless, he did well out of it and he kept his mouth shut. And then after Domitian was eventually assassinated, there was a return of a good emperor, Nerva, and then Trajan, where again there was sort of an uptick in freedom of speech, we say, and Tacitus as in his middle age and old age, older age, we don't know exactly how old he lived to be, was able to write about his experiences. He literally lived through a tyranny, the tyranny of Domitian. And well, here's another quote. He said this: "Think of it, 15 whole years, no small part of a man's life taken from us. All the most energetic have fallen to the cruelty of the emperor, and the few that survive are no longer what we once were. Yet I find some small satisfaction in acknowledging the bondage we once suffered." So he was, end quote. So he was a bit haunted by the fact that he didn't do anything. He didn't really speak out. He didn't fight against it. There's all sorts of elements in his writing where you can tell that he's sort of haunted a little bit by the fact that that's what he did. And as he mentioned there, sort of the best among them were sort of weeded out and done away with. And that's one of the parallels, I think, you see all through the ages when this sort of thing happens, and it's exactly what's happening now, is that when you've got somebody strong and brave who will not be cowed, they're gone after first. They're the people that need to be silenced first. I don't know why Roger Scruton's springing to mind, but there's also people like in the Soviet example. If there are people that will not shut up, then the strongest, the bravest, the most noble, the most proud of men that will not take it. They will not be silent and watch while a despotism is established above them. Well, they're the first ones to go. They're the first ones to go. And this is what we're seeing today, right? By the cancelling, in inverted commas, of people like that. How many in the DR have been yeeted off of YouTube? Right? had their voice stolen?
Yeah.
They're the men that would, if they could, repeatedly speak up. Well, they're the ones whose voices need to be silenced first and foremost.
And again and again in history. And you need to demonize them so that other people will not take them seriously. So the first thing they'll hear about that person is that he's a villain of some kind, you know, right. And he's full of hate. So it's a silly caricature, but it works. It devalues that guy socially, that person. So, yeah, I mean, it's disgusting because, yeah, it's I hate this idea of it's the best of the people, because it's so tragic to think of the best of that group being eliminated. I mean, we're not being eliminated, so thank God, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
But it's so, well, yeah. But it's so hideous to think of the best of a people being eliminated, because then you're left with the weaker, the blander, the more mediocre, whatever. I mean, it's dysgenic. It's permanently dysgenic. And this is what I hate about the First World War, especially, that it was so many a quality of men that we probably don't even realize now. We probably don't even know men as good as this, because the standard has been lowered, because the average has sunk because of what we lost in the First World War. I find that just an absolute tragedy, travesty, awful.
And you talk about the very deliberate attempt to sort of lower the standards in general. That's another thing Tester says, which I find sort of scarcely believable, how prescient it is. That it's exactly what's going on in our age, is that he said tyrannical emperors like Domitian or Nero, they would try and degenerate everything. They would try and do away with nice art, for example, for one example. Do away with nice things. Do away with truthful academia. Try and degrade the people themselves in the broadest sense.
God, that's amazing.
So that they can't, so it's harder for them to even imagine a better way. And isn't that sort of what we say? Look at Hollywood, the degenerate filth that is pumped in onto our screens.
Yeah, or even the BBC. I mean,
all of it,
cultural tastes that are now expected to be, you know, the average person is expected to be into the drivel that the BBC serves up, because the BBC serves up nothing better than that. So
just watch Britain's Got Talent.
Just watch
people eating bugs in the jungle. Just watch that. Don't worry about anything else.
Exactly. Yeah. It's tawdry, low-grade, shitty entertainment. I hate it. I remember when BBC Three, there's BBC One and Two, which are the main channels on terrestrial TV, and then they introduced BBC Three and Four, which were digital channels. And BBC Three was, this is in the late 2000s, BBC Three was utter garbage. Low-brow, low-grade, terrible stuff. And Shameless, like, quite open about it. This is what it is. This is what we're... there was no attempt to dignify it or pretend. There was no pretense that it was anything but trash. They were proud of it. And then, meantime, BBC Four was much more refined and highbrow. And the BBC were constantly flagellating themselves about BBC Four. We've got to change it. It's too middle class. It's too elitist. It's snobbish. And I don't know if they've done that. They said the same about the Radio 4, BBC Radio 4 as well, that it was too highbrow. So it's got to be made. It's got to be brought down. It's got to be degenerated. So you know, it's killing the best of the culture. And in so doing, lowering, degenerating the public themselves, because they don't know. I mean, like your average Zoomer will not know classical music, but he will know rap music.
Drill music or something. Yeah. Don't be noble of spirit. Don't be noble of thought. Just take this filth. Yeah. If you look at art or architecture, you're not encouraged to be proud of it, you know. So take modern art, where it's literally sometimes like a shit, someone taking a shit on a bit of canvas or something, or whatever, or a massive statue that's like just a massive phallus or something, or the architecture doing away with like the Baroque and just having a brutalist concrete block or something. It's like, yeah, don't.
It's deliberately meaningless.
Don't aspire to anything higher.
Yeah, exactly. It's deliberately meaningless, offensive, and empty. It's encouraging that level in people.
Another thing that Tess just talked about, the sort of the nature of the tyranny, the nature of the empire, is that it was sort of it became a self-fulfilling thing where it was never enough, and it was doing it for its own sake. In the end, there's one. I quite like the Oliver Stone film Nixon. Have you ever seen that? With
I think
Anthony Hopkins plays Nixon. Incredibly,
I think I did see it, but I get it mixed up with Hoffa.
Yeah, There's one line in that film, Nixon, which struck me when I first saw it, and I think of it not often, but it sometimes pops into my mind, where it's a fictional scene, but a Vietnam War protester, a young student, says to Nixon, you can't even change anything. It's out of your hands. It's sort of it's the military-industrial complex. Even you, as the president, as the head of state, as the head of the head of the executive, of the commander in chief, you can't even really do anything about it. And Nixon says, no, I can influence things from the inside. I might be able to tame it. And she says, sounds like you're talking about a wild beast. And he says, yeah, maybe I am. Well, it's that way with Rome. It's that way with whatever we're facing in our modern world. There's some sort of wild beast which will destroy and keep going for its own sake. It knows nothing else, like a cloud of locusts or something, or like a virus, a mindless destruction machine of some type. Tacitus wrote, sort of in the broadest sense, about the Roman Empire. He said, quote, brigands of the world, after the earth has failed their all devastating hands, they probe even the sea. If their enemy be wealthy, they are greedy. If he be poor, they are ambitious. Neither the east nor the west has glutted them. They plunder, they slaughter, and they steal. This they falsely name empire, and where they make a wasteland, they call it peace.
Yeah. Someone said that in the chat earlier. They make a desert, call it peace.
Yeah, that's one translation. Yeah. That's probably one of Tacitus's most famous lines. You can't really do a stream about Tacitus and not read that one. But again, perhaps I don't want to particularly rag on the United States, but what they've done, or what the Soviet Union did, what China's doing, is they'll create a wasteland and they'll call it peace. They'll create a desert and they'll say it was done for your good. The idea they'll make sort of bug people and put you in a pod, and it's for your own good. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy. Oh, will we? Okay.
Yeah. Well, and things like the online safety bill is to keep you safe.
Yeah, the Patriot Act. It's for your good. It's for your own good. It's what you want, remember? Orwellian is not even the word. It's beyond Orwellian, isn't it? I mean, I think we have to start bringing it to a close, Woz. But there's one last thing, one last sort of main point I want to sort of mention is that, pardon me, I mentioned sort of the idea of having a higher aspiration, a sort of a refusal to give in to it, a nobility of action or a nobility of bearing, or being fearless in the face of sort of apparently overwhelming odds. Alexander Solzhenitsyn talked about in at one point in the Gulag Archipelago, they were on a hunger strike at one point, and eventually the guards sort of broke their will. There was one guy, a Pole, who, when everyone else's will was broken and they were marched off to the mess hall to have their first meal in days, he just refused. He just rolled over on his bunk and refused and died. And Solzhenitsyn said that if there was more of us that were like him, that did that, that made that sort of ultimate sacrifice, the whole Soviet system, the whole tyranny wouldn't have worked. But what a terrible price. What an unbelievable thing. You have to, I guess we said right near the beginning, that they'll never give power back. They'll never really just give liberties back out of the goodness of their heart. It has to be taken back. It has to be taken back. And now that's an easy thing to say, isn't it? It's an easy thing for me to sit here and say. And yet that's the lesson from history. That is the lesson from history.
And
it bodes for dark times. It bodes for dark times. It really does.
It does. And they make it sound unthinkable and outrageous and evil to take power, to change the status quo, to upset our democracy and so on. But it's actually what's happened all throughout history. So it's that's how things change. And when a status quo has gone rotten and corrupt, and it's bad for people and it's bad for society, and visibly so, then that's when people inevitably do change the status quo one way or another. To talk of it as if it's something unthinkable and just outrageous is very naive. But I think that's what they tell us. I think they know damn well that it's it's not outrageous. It has happened 1,000 times before.
If you look at the American Revolution, the sort of the Sons of Liberty, the Liberty Tree, all sorts of metaphors and allegories about that, about freedom. The idea that you'd fight or even die for liberty, that liberty will reign in America or in the West or in the world. You have to take it. It's not going to be given to you. But I would like this sort of one last sort of point. I would again just stress that I think everyone that's remotely interested in this, perhaps the biggest question of our age, they'll do well to read Tacitus. Start with the Annals on audiobook, if you like, and the picture he paints, the portrait he paints of the first Caesars, certainly, is a remarkable one and a prescient one. I've got one last quote here from historian Tom Holland, who is a bit of a lefty, I must admit. I actually, 95% of his histories are just great, but he is actually, he's a bit woke. Anyway, you know what it's like. Sometimes people are woke, but the vast majority of their body of work is absolutely fine. Anyway, he wrote this about Tacitus, or about the Rome of the first Caesars, and the picture that Tacitus painted of it. He said that Tacitus portrays for us a nightmare, haunted by terror and shadowed by blood, from which it is impossible for her citizens to awake. It is a portrait of despotism that many subsequent generations, witnessing the dimming of their own liberties, have not been slow to recognise. Wherever tyranny has been planted on the ruins of a previously free order, and whenever specious slogans have been used to mask state-sanctioned crimes, it has been remembered. End quote. So, again, if I can persuade even one person out there to read or listen to Tacitus, I would have done a good day's work today.
I'm sure you have done. So I'm sure there will be people who are discovering a newfound interest in especially Tacitus. So thank you for doing this. Thank you for this talk.
No, thank you for having me on. Thank you for the platform. I always appreciate it. If I can ever if I'm ever allowed to blather on about history, I will take the opportunity. So I really do genuinely thank you for the time.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. I'm sorry that I didn't interact much at the beginning, but I was letting you speak because I thought that was what you the best way to go about it. But as it neared the more present day, I was able to interact more, and I think it went fine. I think it went well. Okay, there are a few, couple of super chats. Aethelward says, I'm thinking of starting a YouTube channel that focuses on dissident right content. Would the two of you advise, what is it? It's a good idea to either remain anonymous under an online pseudonym, or should I be ballsy in revealing my face and name? My fear is to be banned from traveling abroad. Well, then the obvious answer is that you should remain anonymous and use an avatar, as you see. Would you have anything to advise that guy?
I am of the feeling that people have got to stand up and be counted and have a fucking set of balls. I'm not one for hiding behind an avatar and a fake name. Just fucking roll the dice, throw the chips high and let it fall where they may.
I mean, things are changing all the time, and it's not 2005 anymore. It's not 2015 anymore. I don't know. I wouldn't want to advise someone to do something this big. I think that's a decision that they have to make themselves. They should don't go into naive. Understand what it is that you'd be throwing away.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah. No, make a calculated decision. Yeah. And if you decide you do want to do it, though, then do it. I mean, if you think about sort of the 60s and 70s, people used to go to prison sort of all the time. Someone like some wishy-washy fucking champagne socialist like Christopher Hitchens, like, was arrested dozens and dozens of times, right? People are a bit afraid now. They're a bit afraid. Like, it's not that bad. Unless you're committing any actual crime, the FBI are not going to stop you from going to America. Like, nothing really happens. I remember what it's like when I first started.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the person who was... several people who have appeared on Millennial, I know, are banned from entering America, and I'm pretty sure I am as well. So,
Survive the Jive got in a spot of bother. But that's the trade-off. If you want to stand up and be counted, that is the trade-off. Now, I can be blasé about it, because I've already crossed that Rubicon, for want of a better metaphor. So it's easy for me to sort of, well, not easy, but, you know, I can sit here and say, you know, I've done it. It's sort of behind me. I've made that decision. But yeah, do think carefully about it and have a calculated decision. But if you do want to sort of man up, feel free.
All right. I would basically say the same thing. Be aware of what you're doing, but it is the noble thing to do. It is the manly thing to do. And it is the nest. I mean, a lot of people, you know, you can make an impact while being anonymous, but I think it sets a good example to people if you're not anonymous. Now, I say that as someone I didn't do this voluntarily. My anonymity was taken from me by force, as it were. But yeah, I do think people admire someone who does this openly.
Wasn't it liberating to you, though, when it happened?
It was a relief when it happened.
Right, yeah.
Several times I had nightmares about it happening. Like in the year or two before, I would have... But only a few times. So it was on my mind, you know. It is something that you can lose. It's something that they can take from you. So in that sense, it is, the manly thing to just get rid of it yourself, to discard it yourself.
When I made the decision to go by my real name and show my real face, it was sort of scary. But then once I did it, it was liberating. It was like a weight off. It's like, no, this is me. This is the real me, though. You can't take that away now. There's nothing you can take away from me in that sense anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's liberating, if anything.
I do agree. I do agree. Okay. Caesar himself says, History Bro Appreciation Society donation. Then thank you for that. It's $2. Thank you. Dino Legovic, support those who are in the eye of Sauron. Yes, we are. So thank you very much. And Dino also says, love History Bro. Very good. Charlemagne says, the problem with history is that it never seems to end. There's always more of it. Thank you. Yeah, very good.
According to Fukuyama.
Oh, well, indeed. Indeed.
Although he was obviously wrong, wasn't he?
He certainly was. And it's alarming how quickly he's been proven wrong. You know, 20 years later, it just seems preposterous to say such a thing.
Have you ever seen him trying to squirm and get out of that, saying, that's not really what I meant?
I've heard that he's said that, oh, I didn't actually mean it literally or something like that. But yeah, I know about that, yeah. Let's see. Oh, Texas Red made a very kind donation earlier. Thank you very much. Alex, does History Bro have his discussions available to download on audio-only format?
Oh, I don't know. There's just my history channel, History Bro, and on YouTube, and I don't know. I'm a bit of a boomer when it comes to technical stuff. So I don't know if they're just audio somewhere. It's also all on Odyssey, I think, isn't it?
I think you can download audio from Odyssey. I think so. I'm not sure.
Sorry.
Yeah. Black Pigeon Pilled, does History Bro prefer the Republic or the Empire when it comes to Rome?
I've got to say the Republic. I think if you read Livy's really, and Polybius stuff on the Republic. Yeah, the sort of middle to late Republic is, but also it depends what mood you get me in. It's like, what's your favourite film? What's your favourite song? It depends what mood you're in, doesn't it, really?
Sometimes you feel like Joy Division and sometimes New Order.
Right.
And then Black Pigeon Pilled also said, can you say a few words about what you think prompted Rome to fall? But that was 25 minutes ago. So I think you... Yeah. Do you want to say anything else there?
All I'll say is that Edward Gibbon wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and it's like this long on a shelf. So it's a process which took a few hundred years.
Yeah.
So there's no quick way, there's no quick sentence to say on that.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, well, let's end it there then. Well, this has been a very good talk, very useful, informative for people, I think.
I hope so.
So thank you very much. I'll be back in maybe 10 or 15 minutes. I'll need to take a break to get something to eat. And I've forgotten who's on next. Let me just...
Lady of Shalott, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Lady of Shalott. So I'll be back then. In the meantime, History Bro, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Thank you.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. Bitcoin, Ethereum, Monero, and other cryptocurrencies are all very welcome. Find the info at millennial.com/crypto and make your donation. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.